Our Chancellor and Premier, members of the Little family and other distinguished guests, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure and an honour for me to be invited to give this lecture in memory of Ian Little. I worked with Ian when we were young recruits at the Reserve Bank back in the early 1980s, and I remember an easygoing young man with a mop of curly dark hair. That was when I had hair as well. Even then, Ian was a clear thinker and was obviously strongly committed to good public policy. So although he left the bank in the late 80s and succeeded in the private sector, it wasn't surprising, I don't think, that he would return to public service in the Victorian Treasury. And as many of you here know better than me, that is a role in which he shone. I'd occasionally run into Ian at conferences after he'd left the Reserve Bank, and he would always impress on me, a macroeconomist working in a central bank, the importance of microeconomic policies in bettering economic performance. And it's an important point. While it's certainly the case that macroeconomic policies are to the fore at present, as governments and central banks seek to foster recovery from recession, in the long term our living standards depend rather more on innovation and productivity and rather less on the manipulation of interest rates and aggregate spending decisions by governments than common discussion might allow. Real prosperity depends critically on the supply side of the economy. The realm of microeconomic policies and the area in which Ian made so many of his important contributions. So it's in that spirit today that I want to talk about something that's more microeconomic in nature, namely the payment system. The Reserve Bank, of course, is better known for our macroeconomic responsibilities, but we have in fact an important microeconomic obligation as well, namely the competitiveness and efficiency of the payment system, including at the retail level. That's an obligation given to the payment system board of the bank as a result of the Wallace inquiry process of the mid-1980s, and so that is the topic that I want to address tonight. We might begin by asking, why is an efficient payment system important? And the answer is that payment systems facilitate all the other economic and financial activity in the economy. There are, on an average business day in Australia, some 18 million transactions with a total value of around $230 billion every working day. With that many payments, even relatively small inefficiencies can potentially have significant implications for the cost of the payment system and therefore for the broader economy. Part of the bank's job, therefore, is to promote efficient arrangements in that system in the interests of the broader economy. Reforms to the high-value payment system, which we actually operate across our balance sheet quite some years ago, have improved efficiency and safety there. But achieving efficiency and safety reforms in the retail area has been a slower process. In fulfilling those responsibilities over the past decade, we have in some fairly high-profile cases resulted ultimately to regulation. That is not because we had a strong predilection for regulatory solutions. On the contrary, we have usually first sought to achieve improvements in efficiency and competition without direct regulation. We've sought to encourage the players in this space to identify potential improvements and undertake reforms themselves in order to achieve those improvements. But such industry-led reforms have sometimes been difficult to achieve, and so ultimately we have on occasion needed to resort to a regulation. So I want to talk about why that's the case, and do so by making reference to a recent example. My observations are framed within the payment space, but I think in some respects they generalise to other areas, particularly in network industries where regulators are seeking to spur improvements in efficiency and in productivity. A key theme here is that in payment system, as with other networks, a certain amount of cooperation is needed between participants to ensure that the network functions with benefits to users. When you or I go into a retailer and we pull out this card or that, we expect that when we swipe it and enter a PIN or a signature, that it doesn't matter who we bank with or who our retailer banks with. We assume that the system and the network will transfer our money to the retailer efficiently. That is, we expect that it will just work. That, of course, requires a detailed set of cooperative arrangements between all the financial institutions, our bank, the retailer's bank, and so on. But those same institutions are also competing with each other to get customers, and a common way you do that is you offer a product or a service that your competitor does not. But if the ability to offer that product relies on your competitor making adjustments to their systems, as it does in the case of a network, then it's possible that innovation can be stymied. Why would other banks be willing to incur costs to facilitate the customers, the competitors? So the tension between those two separate dynamics, the need for cooperation in order to get network efficiencies on the one hand, but the impulse to competition on the other, means that the industry may have difficulty taking decisions which are in the interest of the system as a whole and of the community more broadly. In those circumstances, somebody, and that could be an industry group, or it could be a regulator, needs to play a coordinating role to encourage improvements in the infrastructure that benefit everyone, while still allowing competitive forces to ensure that new products are priced competitively and packaged to meet the needs of customers. Well, that set of issues, of course, is neither new nor is it unique to payments. It's well accepted in the economics literature that industries that rely on networks, so-called network industries, may have an incentive to cooperate to gain efficiencies, but might fall short of the socially optimal level of cooperation. A case which is often talked about in the literature, which I might dwell on just for a moment, is the development of railway networks, and there's quite a literature on the development of the United States network in the 19th century. The early system here consisted of a whole group of single lines which connected two destinations, often on tracks with different gauges, different design. Obviously, there's a clear public benefit in customers being able to link between those various networks so that goods and passengers can cross efficiently from one railway to another. But in fact, initially some of these railways were actually designed to be incompatible in order to prevent leakage of customers to your competition. Well, eventually the commercial logic for cooperation was sufficient to ensure that standardisation occurred to some extent. And when that happened, it brought very large gains in productivity. In the space of a decade, the time for shipment of goods by rail between Philadelphia and Chicago went from 9 weeks to 3 days. Despite those payoffs, standardisation was still at that stage not complete, and in fact the only way that railways reached what people consider to be an optimal level of standardisation was horizontal integration, that is, mergers between the competitors. Well, that might sound a million miles from a 21st century electronic payment system, but there are some parallels. Like the linking of the railways, the realisation that a single interconnected FPOS system was more valuable than a number of individual FPOS systems that couldn't talk to each other drove cooperation and standardisation quite early in the development of that system. Yet despite the benefits that that brought, cooperation, standardisation and innovation in Australia's FPOS system has not progressed as far as is desirable. the system has remained essentially unchanged since its establishment in the early 1980s. The fact that the system is built on bilateral links between the major participants, rather like the old bilateral railways, means that there's no one standardised communications protocol between the participants. Cooperative efforts to innovate or upgrade the system are complicated because they require all those bilateral relationships to be renegotiated. And that is in fact a difficulty with many of Australia's payment systems. Many of them are based on bilateral links with no well-established mechanism to foster improvements and expansion in the network. So left to their own devices, it's possible that networks can stop short of an efficient level of cooperation. Incomplete standardisation can result. Innovation and movement from one standard to a superior one can be delayed. The literature sets out a number of reasons why that's the case, and they're already evident, in fact, from the things I've just said. The first is that there's a classic economic externality. Firms within the network might be concerned that if they agree a common standard with the competitor, that competitor may be able to capture some or a large share of the benefits of moving to that standard. Why would I pay to convert my railway line to a standard gauge or my FPOS messaging system to a standard when my competitor will gain as much of my rail traffic as I will of his? So competitors might not individually make decisions which are optimal for the network as a whole. A second problem is the ineffectiveness of many voluntary strategies for achieving cooperation. Typically, there are industry bodies that seek to agree standards, but the success of those, at least in our case, has been mixed. Agreement can be delayed where there are vested interests, and in some cases, of course, non-standardisation is used as a barrier to entry by competitors. And thirdly, there's often a tendency towards excess inertia in standards. Problems with coordinating the movement from an old standard to a new and superior one can mean that the movement doesn't occur or occurs very slowly, even where the costs to society of the switch are outweighed by the benefits. So they are the backdrop here to these problems. Let me talk then more specifically. From first principles, you might think, therefore, that in achieving agreement among Australian financial institutions to develop the payment system, that agreement might not be easy to find. And so it has proved. Let me talk about the ATM system as an example. Now, of course, you're all aware that just recently there have been some changes in the way ATM transactions, which are not at a machine owned by your own bank, will be priced and will be charged for. Instead of paying a relatively obscure foreign fee that you only learn about at the end of the month on your account, you'll now be presented with the cost of the transaction on the screen in real time and asked do you want to proceed or not. In our opinion, that will over time allow competitive forces to come into play in a way which wasn't possible before. But the process of achieving the reforms rather than the benefits of them is what I want to talk about tonight. In particular, this required changes in all the bilateral links between all the major players in the system. So it's a little bit like the old railways analogy. How do we get all the players to change the gauge in a way that's standardised? Work on this by the industry began as long ago as 2001. Some progress was made over the next few years, but ultimately the participants could not agree. So they asked the Payment System Board of the Reserve Bank for guidance on a way forward. After quite a lot of cajoling by the bank behind the scenes, the new arrangements were finally implemented earlier this month, some 8 years after the discussions commenced. Ironically, the package implemented differs very little from a proposal put forward by the industry group itself in 2004 but subsequently abandoned due to apparently irreconcilable differences between some of the major parties. Despite a firm desire by the industry to implement these arrangements without the Reserve Bank regulating, in fact, ultimately the industry asked the bank to utilise its regulatory powers to help finalise and give certainty to the process. This is not a unique example. reforms to most of Australia's payment system, including cheques, direct entry and FPOS, faced or do face similar challenges. And as we've seen, that's not necessarily surprising given the network nature of the payment system, the number of players which need to cooperate but also compete. The bilateral architecture I've already mentioned is also a difficulty. Every large bank has an agreement with every other large bank about how to handle payments from one another's customers. So the more banks there are, the more such agreements are needed, and the more complicated the system is. To use the railway analogy again, the more customised tracks get built, the more difficult the task of ultimately converting all of them to a standard gauge. So while bilateral agreements can be helpful in getting a system started initially, and they may work well for the incumbents, potential new entrants face the prospect of negotiating numerous different connections. That can act as a barrier to entry, inhibiting competition. Secondly, because upgrading the network requires all the participants to agree, since they all must make changes, each participant can effectively therefore veto or at least delay any decision affecting the network. Because they all have different technology cycles, different strategic interests, there's a high probability that some participant will be unwilling to proceed at any given point in time. If a participant thinks that a change will give an advantage to another, it's likely to want to delay. If one participant sees a potential advantage to a change, almost certainly, by definition, some other party will see a disadvantage and then therefore seek to block it. So that results in a significant coordination problem for the industry. The result of that is that the underlying architecture of the payment system has changed very little over the past 20 or 30 years, even though technology has evolved in that quarter of a century since the technology that underlies ATMs and FPOS and so on was first established. So while the payments architecture has served Australia well, pressures for change are building. The network structure needs to be updated, and services to customers are starting to fall behind those available in other countries. In the past, the Reserve Bank has identified things like real-time internet payments, business-to-business payments, and online payment mechanisms as areas where progress is being made overseas, but to date here has not been made, or at least not very quickly. All these coordination challenges were evident in the process of ATM reform. To give just a couple of examples, small institutions would only consider a system that allowed them to form fee-free networks between each other, otherwise they'd be at a competitive disadvantage to the big banks, who of course have very large networks. But the larger institutions saw an advantage to have a competitive gain over the smaller ones if the smaller ones were prevented from forming fee-free networks. There's also a reluctance, or there was a reluctance, to improve and liberalise access to the system. While improved access would increase the benefits to everyone collectively by increasing the network, each bank tends to focus on the cost that it individually would bear, as well as the competition it would face. So in short, there were problems because there was no one in the system who could drive things from the point of view of the benefit to the system as a whole, and no one who had the power to affect that change, at least not in the private sector. In some countries, that role is handled by a single private entity that manages the system. In credit cards, for example, there is a central body who's responsible for governance, innovation and promotion. Their incentive is to do things which make the network easier and more attractive to use, and so grow it. They have, in effect, internalised some of the externalities that are inherent in the network. Now, in the credit card case, there are other things to do with those centralised governance arrangements which we didn't approve of and sought to regulate to some extent. But nonetheless, from the point of view of growing networks, arguably a centralised body is superior. Some private payment systems in other countries also have such an entity. For example, in the UK or Canada or New Zealand, there are entities whose job is to preside over a network for ATMs and FPOS, and who have an incentive to grow that network. That entity appears to be missing in the Australian payment system. So all those considerations suggest that there is an important role for public policy in promoting change in this area. The academic literature is generally divided, as it tends to be, on the role of regulation in network industries, and not surprising because it's a very complex area. But there does seem to be some support for careful regulatory intervention in industries where, with competing network components, where sufficient standardisation or a move between standards can't be achieved in a timely way. There seems to be considerable sense, as I've said, in having an entity with a responsibility to consider the interests of the system and of society as a whole, and some power to achieve reform to that end. And that's, of course, why the Wallace Committee and the government of the day created the Payment System Board at the bank and gave it the powers and obligations that they did. It's unusual internationally, one would have to say, for the central bank to fill this role. In many countries, issues of competition in and efficiency of payment systems falls to the competition authority, the ACCC equivalent. But it is nonetheless common to find structures in place in network industries generally to assist in promoting access and in the efficient setting of standards. Often there's a public body that sits above private bodies that attempt to do this coordination, which has powers ultimately to enforce or set standards. We see that in network industries here in Australia, in telecommunications, in electricity, in ports and so on. Of course, such bodies should not take a decision to regulate in haste. In most cases, a graduated approach to regulation is pursued, reflecting a reluctance to assume that a regulatory solution necessarily will be superior, and reflecting, I think, quite properly, a reluctance to assume that a government body will necessarily choose the best standard to enforce, particularly in an industry where standards and technology are evolving quickly. So the typical approach is to prefer a cooperative solution by the industry, to provide suasion where that process is unsuccessful, but ultimately to be prepared to set a standard where that's necessary. So there isn't, on our part, a presumption that a black letter regulatory solution should be adopted. And in fact, at the time that the current Australian arrangements were established, there was an expectation, I think, that a co-regulatory model would generally be followed. In that view, industry would progress reform for the most part. The bank's powers would be used only occasionally as a last resort, and where reform could not otherwise be achieved. As it's turned out, as I said at the beginning, the bank's powers have had to be used more often than I suspect was originally intended. We do always explore the ways for our statutory goals of competition and efficiency to be achieved without resorting to direct regulatory powers. But the history of the ATM reforms and others demonstrates how hard it is for pure industry-based reform to move ahead with at least a pretty big push from some public body. So reflecting on that experience and thinking about the future, the question is how to strike the best balance. And I see three potential approaches, each of which we've used and which I think we will continue to use, and so let me set out clearly what they are. The first one, and the least interventionist one, is that the bank agrees targets and timelines with the industry, but without any explicit regulation or penalty or sanction for failure to meet the target. That is, in fact, what the industry body, the Australian Payments Clearing Association, or APCA, actually does with its projects now. Provided that the need for change can be agreed, and that's no small matter in this industry, APCA plays a coordinating role in organising a plan, it provides resources, and it sets timelines and targets. In the absence of agreement, though, within the industry on the need for change, these industry-based projects, which after all rely on there being agreement, tend not to proceed very quickly. So the second option, and a rather more interventionist one, is where the possibility or even the threat of Reserve Bank overt regulation is itself enough to forge agreement among industry participants. Hurry up and agree, otherwise we will agree for you. This is the path that was predominantly followed in progressing reform of ATMs and in some other cases in the payments area. Where industry agreement was not forthcoming, the bank has engaged the various sides behind the scenes to seek a solution, but let it be known fairly clearly that we were prepared to regulate if an agreement could not be reached. And that approach was also used in some cases in this area in the UK, where there was the knowledge that if the private initiatives could not succeed, there would be official intervention. Well, that can work, and it emphasises the bank playing a coordination role rather than a regulatory one, but the ATM experience suggests that it can be a drawn-out process. Individual participants who have a preference for the status quo, and there are some, always, have no incentive to push things along, so it relies on us and the Reserve Bank setting a timetable for agreement and implementation, a timetable which is invariably argued by the participants to be, quote, challenging, unquote. And then the third and more intrusive option is for the bank to set explicit standards to do traditional regulation. And that is the approach we took in dealing with credit cards, where we set a number of standards on interchange fees and the imposition of surcharges. That approach could, however, also be used to achieve industry coordination around technical issues. For example, the bank could set technical standards where the industry has been unable to agree on them itself. Such an approach may yet become relevant in some areas of the electronic payment system. Some have suggested, for example, that the bank could play a further role in the development of FPOS. Now, this system was designed originally to transfer money out of your account to the retailer's account right now with instantaneous effect. In recent years, however, there's been increasing demand to use the system in the other direction, to send payments into customers' accounts in real time. When you think about it, those demands can come from, say, governments who want to give assistance after a natural disaster and they want to do so promptly. The FPOS system at present technically can only accommodate those sorts of payments in a fairly limited way. While some participants in the industry have seen benefit in expanding the messaging format that would enable that, there's been limited progress to date. A requirement by the Reserve Bank that all participants in the industry be able to accept instructions conforming to a common standard would facilitate that. It would facilitate access by new entrants and also competition. If the bank chose to require use of an international standard, it would facilitate also competition potentially from overseas providers of payment services. A mandate from the Reserve Bank that FPOS message format be able to support credit transactions might likewise lay the foundation for innovation in the system more quickly than the industry might be able to achieve by itself. So they are possibilities. To date, as I've said, the credit card arrangements being the exception, we have preferred the first two of the options I've laid out. Leave it to the industry or cajole them with the implicit threat of regulation if they can't hurry up. That's particularly been the case in regard to technical issues and architecture, where we've raised the issues but let the industry get on with driving the reform. And we are conscious that public intervention itself, if it's done badly or done too often, can be an impediment to innovation. So we've said a number of times that we hope the industry will deal with these things itself. But we also know that if the industry fails to push ahead with some of these improvements, Australians will be denied the full benefits of a modern retail payment system. So to a large extent, the future approach of the Payment System Board will depend on the behaviour of the industry participants. If they can agree on further reforms quickly, then the need for our coordinating role will be just limited to the non-interventionist type.
On the other hand, if, as on some past occasions,
the industry is unable to carry forward reform and innovation by itself, the bank would consider making more extensive use of the tools at its disposal. Well, let me conclude. The economics of networks are complex, and the role of public policy is a delicate one. The aim is to ensure as far as we can that the correct balance is struck between the need for cooperation and the benefits of competition. We need cooperation in order to ensure that the benefits of extensive, reasonably well standardised network can be enjoyed by the public, because that raises economic welfare. Competition, on the other hand, is vital in the long run to make sure costs are minimised and that the incentive to respond to changing consumer preferences is maximised. So policy has to recognise and fulfil its role in dealing with the externalities which are inherent in networks, while also respecting and maintaining the competitive dynamic. We recognise that the roles of the industry participants and of the regulator are mutually interdependent. We hope that the industry recognises that too. The Payment System Board is content to confine itself to encouraging industry solutions and being the occasional catalyst for agreement, as long as that achieves the goals that the board has been given. But it is and must be also prepared, if needed, to use regulatory powers more forcefully. In judging which approach is preferred, we will respond to the industry's behaviour just as they respond to ours. Of course, the approach we adopt in any instance has to be tailored to the circumstances, and we on occasion ourselves will have to innovate. What will be constant is the set of statutory goals that we've been given, and that is controlling risk and promoting competition and efficiency in the payment system in all its dimensions. The board is committed to those objectives and will be pragmatic but determined in pursuing them. We look forward to effective engagement with the industry in the process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir, for today's speech. Thank you very much, sir, for today's speech. I'm not an economist, I'm a musician, so I'm way out of my depth here, but I must ask, in the light...
We'll look to you for inspiration.
That's right. But in the light that the Reserve Bank has these tools you speak of to enforce overt regulation within the bilateral architecture, how useful is an arbitrary entity to you?
Well, I think the point about the architecture is that when you think about the number of bilateral links, when you've got 20, 30, 40 institutions, that's a very complex structure to ever change. And there is an argument, I think, that says that a network architecture with a common set of messaging standards that a new entrant connects to only once, and that's how you get into credit cards, you connect to the system rather than to every other provider, that an arrangement like that admits more competitive tension, because you can get more new competitors in more inexpensively. And when there are reforms and improvements to the network that need to be done, it's easier to get agreement to do them, because you've got somebody whose job it is to actually think about, how do I make the network easier to use, cheaper to use, more attractive? At the moment, in some of the systems, we don't really have that to the extent that we might. So I think the potential value of some kind of structure of that nature is that it improves the ability to innovate and get change over time. And the banks, for example, are thinking about how to structure this in the FPOS case at the moment, with some encouragement from us.
John Freeband, University of Melbourne. I guess my question, Glenn, is how much effort and time should the bank spend in trying to understand all these new innovations? That is, should you have quite a big army of people who really understand what's going on, what are the options, things like benchmarking? And then my other sort of question is, we're in a world of innovation, and a regulator like any other investor in innovation is going to screw up occasionally.
Yeah.
Are you going to be so risk-averse that you just sort of keep away from the main game? Or can you admit that you might screw up and give us the QWERTY keyboard because something better came down the track?
Well, it's a good question how many resources we should devote to tracking down every innovation in this area, or for that matter, how many resources should we devote to retail payments as opposed to some of the other obligations that the bank has and the Payment System Board has. And I think about that a lot, and you know that's a resource management decision that we have to make, and our various critics out there will judge over time whether we made them correctly. Will we be too risk averse? Well, I think the bank's been prepared to take the odd risk on some other things, and I think we've been prepared to be a fair bit more interventionist in this industry than this industry had been accustomed to seeing, and we've spent a lot of public money fighting court cases as a result. So I don't think we were unduly risk averse there. It's a matter, I think, of striking the right balance between being prepared to be a bit pushy when we thought that was appropriate, but not wanting to kind of think that we will always know better than the market in where things are going to go in the future. So it's a hard balance to strike, but I don't think that my colleagues on the Payment System Board could be accused as yet of being a risk averse. They're a pretty aggressive bunch on occasion, I've found. So some of them are here. So not too much risk aversion so far, I think, John. And I guess you'll judge us later on.
Hi, Alan Finkel here. I want to say that I think that the micro-regulation system you're using or you've implemented seems to be working. I never have any problems with my bank accounts or getting a transaction done. It always goes smoothly. I'm wondering what you're doing about thinking about integrating in other payment systems with new technology. Specifically, what I'm thinking of is allowing payments by mobile phones. Apparently, the technology exists. You read about it as a proposed system to use your mobile phone to pay for a parking meter or a transaction in a shop, but how do you integrate in the billing systems of the mobile phone carriers with the banks, and would you regulate that?
Would we regulate it? The test we have to apply is, is it in the public interest for us to designate, as the technical term, which just means bring it under our regulatory purview or not? Most things that are very small, we tend to think we might regulate them if they get really big. We might need to, but the costs to them and to us of doing it yet probably outweigh any benefits. So a number of those innovations and things like PayPal and so on are similar. We watch them. We ask ourselves, is this an issue for us? And we maintain a watching brief without necessarily jumping to the assumption that if it pops up somewhere, we've got to run over and regulate it. I mean, we don't have that attitude. There are a number of those sorts of innovations which potentially, maybe your phone, maybe some other card like they have in other countries where you can pay for a whole bunch of things including your train fare with a card that you put money on, and there are issues there. All I can say about those at this point is we try to keep abreast of those developments and ask ourselves the question, is there a public interest issue here? If there is, then we go further. But if there's not a significant public interest issue, we tend to leave them alone rather than feel that, you know, every single thing that comes up, we've got to run and put a ring around. So it's we'll see is the answer, as in many things. So.
Governor John Brumby, thank you for an excellent speech tonight. My question really goes to more of the introductory comments I think you made in introducing the payment system, and that is your comments about the importance of the supply side and particularly microeconomic reforms in driving a more dynamic and a larger economy. And I just wonder, in terms of the current global crisis, what areas would you single out in the Australian economy and the international economy as most benefiting from specific areas of micro-reform, and what would those areas of micro-reform be?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I mean, the first thing to say, of course, is at present, right now, the fundamental problem is not enough supply, it's not enough demand. So what people are doing around the world at the moment is firstly trying to make sure we can get enough demand, particularly in those countries where it is really slumped very badly, and it has slumped very badly in quite a number of cases. So the one order of business is find some demand. On the supply side, the obvious candidate, I guess, is something which is also somewhat in our purview, and that's financial arrangements. I think, I'll preface this by saying I think we've been saying all along that Australia's financial system is sound, is well regulated, is working well, and that continues 18 months into this event. I think you can still say that with a straight face and with your hand on your heart. But internationally, obviously, there have been some serious shortcomings in that area, and there's a lot of work now going on in international fora to reform regulatory arrangements and a whole host of areas. So given that we're getting a rather painful lesson abroad in how important a well-functioning system of capital markets and financial intermediation is, I think the number one thing on most people's minds would be to fix that. I'm not sure that can be done in a very short time. I think it takes quite a long time, but there's a lot of work going on under the auspices of the Financial Stability Forum and G20 and so on, aiming at sorting out things that we had already identified that were wrong and trying to address some of the new things we've learnt. So that is certainly one. I think the other thing that is imperative at this point, and this is an old point, but it would be disastrous, in my view, for us to turn back from open trade, in both in goods and, for that matter, in capital markets. And you see the tendency to this, it's always there when you have recessions in various countries, but you see it at the moment, it's in disguise. It's, you know, it's assistance to such and such an industry that's struggling, but if you're not careful, that can turn into protection. If we're not careful, we will get some governments who've assisted their financial sectors leaning on them to make sure the lending's done at home, not elsewhere, and Australia obviously would be disadvantaged to some extent if that occurred here. Some of our neighbours in Asia would be much more disadvantaged if that happened. And there are other things. So I think more than any other time, maybe in a long time, now is a time not just to mouth that we support free trade, but to make sure we do. They're two really big things, and you know, the other micro reforms that we should keep doing, obviously, to make our economies more flexible and durable. You know, obviously, we should keep doing them, but I would nominate making sure the financial regulation changes are done well, which means, by the way, not overdoing it. I'm old enough to remember a world in which we had much more regulation here. And when I first joined the Reserve Bank, the debate was all about that didn't work. What are we going to do that's different? We don't actually want to go back to that world. We shouldn't forget the difficulties that it had. But so getting the regulatory reform on the finance sector right and keeping the global trading system open, you know, that's going to be no small task, and I'd nominate those two first.
When you talked about innovation and regulations, my mind wandered to the United States of America. Our current crisis, to a great extent, had its origin in a problem of innovation, the structured products. I'm sure you know all about it. Now, the question I have is this: how come that we avoided this problem here? And for that matter, another country I'm thinking of, Spain, which had a big housing boom and then a slump, also avoided that problem. What did we do that the Americans, for example, could learn from on this, on the, well, which regard of that?
apart from superb policies by the RBA and APRA, of course. Let's take that as given. The Spanish case is of interest to people at present because of the potential pro-cyclicality of capital standards, risk ratings that the market does, and accounting standards. And the Spanish case is of interest because of the capacity that the authorities had there to have a countervailing countercyclical provisioning policy. It didn't, by the way, stop them having a big housing boom and a very big bust and a recession, but it does seem to have meant that their banks, their main banks anyway, are fine. There are some other entities that are not banks in that country that are maybe not so fine, but the key banks anyway are strong. So that's one thing. What did we do? Well, we didn't have much of a subprime market. We had some. We had some fringe lenders who were prepared to take the borrowers that the banks wouldn't take and who relied on securitisation. The business model existed here, but it was very small as a share of the market, 1%, not 20. And, you know, had the boom gone on many more years, maybe we would have had a bit more of that. But as it turned out, that was trivially small here, really, in the broader scheme of things, and it stopped early. So that's good. I think also that you know, the banks were pretty well run, and they had many opportunities for sound, normal lending here in an economy that was growing quickly, where households were inclined to borrow, where households started with very low gearing at the beginning and were interested in gearing up. That was a great opportunity for our banks. They took it. They, by and large, I think, managed it pretty well. And they didn't need to go and do exotic things in the United States the way the banks of some other countries in Europe did. So that was an advantage that we had. And on top of that, I think we do have, we didn't have the very large so-called shadow banking sector that the Americans had that wasn't regulated. We haven't got that to the same extent. The important bits of our system are subject to proper regulation, and that's also been a very big factor. So there's a few things that I'd nominate. Bill.
Bill Evans from Westpac. Governor, you referred to the fact that we have a very strong financial system, and I think when we compare the response of the British banks to the easing strategy by the Bank of England and how far mortgage rates were cut compared to Australia, where you cut by 400 basis points and mortgage rates have come down by 375. Mm. But recently we've seen some saber-rattling by some banks about their ability to continue to cut rates in a...
I'm sure not by Westpac, but...
Well, actually, I don't think it has been by Westpac, yeah. But there was a report today about a CEO of a bank that made that point in a presentation in this city.
Yeah.
Would you say that at some point it will not be possible for banks to pass on rate cuts, and would that define the low point of any rate cut cycle?
Would I say that there'll come a point where they can't pass anything on the hypothetical assumption that there are more reductions in the cash rate coming, about which, of course, I offer no comment. I think, by and large, the story here is that funding costs have come down a lot. Funding comes from a whole variety of sources. Some of those sources, the costs haven't come down as much as others, but by and large, the total has come down a lot, and that's why the loan rates have been able to come down. In addition to that, there is less competition for the major banks now than there was, and they are able, I think, to enjoy a bit more pricing power than they had been, and that's a reality of the environment we're in. But you know, does that mean that there's no further effectiveness of Australian monetary policy? I wouldn't have drawn that conclusion myself just yet, without wanting to offer any comment on how likely that change is.
Good evening, Mr. Stevens. Neil Woolrich from the ABC's Late Line Business Program. Thanks for your address tonight and for taking our questions. Just on the US policy response, I was interested to hear your thoughts on their announcement this week from the US Treasury on how they're going to help relieve banks of their troubled loans. And do you think that policy has a chance of working?
Well, it certainly has a chance of working, and it's been, I think, if you look at financial market responses to date, it's been well received. Of course, it's early days yet. But what are the elements needed here? Well, the elements are you've got to somehow quarantine these assets so that they no longer can continually erode the capital position of banks. That's first. And then second, you've got to have enough capital in the banking system. And a fundamental problem has been in the past couple of years there wasn't enough capital globally in the global banking system for the amount of risk that was being taken. So they're the elements you've got to have. You can do this a few ways. You can have a sort of good bank, bad bank situation. You can insure the assets for a price, which is what the UK is doing. You, in principle, can internalise all of this by nationalising the bank. And then you can have the government prepared to put in capital under some set of conditions once we know how much capital is needed. You need those things. There are a few different ways you can do this. The way that gets chosen, I think, depends a bit on the situation you face and the politics of you know how you're going to get it through the political process. But that plan has the elements, and so can it work? Yes. Will it work? I don't know. I can't be sure. But so far, it seems to have been well received, and our American colleagues have to continue to implement it and deliver it in a sensible way, and the banks involved have to have enough confidence to take part in the program. And we need the private investors that the Americans are seeking to get on side. You know, they need to feel confident to do that. It looks like they will to me. So yes, it's got the elements that you need. It has a good chance of succeeding. Whether it actually finally will, I don't know. We don't know yet, but I would say so far, so good.